Welcome to this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast, The Wire Remix, Season 2, Episode 5, Undertow. As always, I am joined by one Robert Sapp. How you doing, Mr. Sapp?
Doing very well. How you doing? Trying to stay cool.
That's all. Trying to stay healthy and cool.
There you go.
The basic essentials. This episode was directed by Steve Schill. It is ranked by Vulture to number 53 all time in terms of Wire episodes. The epigraph, of course, was by Spiros. They used to make steel. They used to make steel there. No, with a question mark. And getting back to our doc themes, as far as undertow or words, undertow can be defined as a tide that traps unsuspecting swimmers. And there were a number of unsuspecting swimmers in this episode when you think about Frank Zabaka, Ziggy Zabaka, and Avon Barksdale, just to name a few. You see characters who are trapped by their circumstances. You see characters who are in over their heads, and you see characters who can't see things coming. And of course, in the case of one, Avon Barksdale, we'll certainly get to that over the course of the episode. But we begin with Ziggy.
Ziggy.
Your man.
My man.
Gets ripped off by a new character we get introduced to in terms of Frog, who's a drug dealer on the corner. Frog, Ziggy, of course, claims that he owes him more money. Frog says, look, Frog comes up short with the money. And Ziggy, you know, it's like, you know, it was a G-pack. So this did not come out right. In terms of for it being the value of a G-pack. Frog, of course, claims that stash was taken. So he claims that the stash was taken and that it came up short. Ziggy, of course, is incensed by this, but no one takes Ziggy seriously as far as any physical threat. So Frog basically, you know, stares at him, and Ziggy just, you know, gets frustrated, is just pissed off. But before he could even get angry for more than 2 minutes, we get introduced to a new character, one Cheese Wagstaff, who of course was played by Method Man. And this character will be a essential character to the story from seasons on for the rest of the series. But at this point, we don't know. We just know that he's a drug man, and he's somebody who is not to be fucked with, as he takes Ziggy's car. Ziggy, of course, owes him money, and Ziggy doesn't have the money that he was going to get from that G-pack from Frog. I'm assuming that was going to be used, going to use that to pay Method Man, to pay Cheese. Ziggy, of course, comes up short. Cheese basically gives Ziggy a week to come up with the money before he kills him. He says, if you don't have the money on Friday, you'll be dead on Saturday. So he takes the money, refuses the coat, takes the money, that the little money that Ziggy does have, and of course takes Ziggy's car, Princess. And Ziggy at this point has nothing but a ripped up jacket and a hurt ego to boot. Pay attention closely to Ziggy getting pumped. Because it's going to be important moving forward as far as the direction of his character. What are your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, it was a great intro scene.
Yes.
For the character of Cheese. I also was struck by how similar this scene was to a scene that will happen in season 4. Different tone, but still same kind of idea. So this is something that they revisit more than once in The Wire.
Yeah, great opening scene. Again, we getting introduced to two new characters. Of course, one will play more of a role than the other, but still for this season, those two characters will be part, will have their times during the course of the rest of the season. Of course, so we move on to Carver and Daniels. So a bit of a reunion between those two. Carver, of course, is wondering why Daniels would want him for this new detail. And Daniels basically says, you know, I know that you wouldn't be basically crazy enough to fuck me over twice. And the fact, you know, we talked about this last season, that he sees something in Carver.
Yeah.
And so it's continuing on with that theme. And he basically dressed Carver down. He says, look, I already know your character. So it's not like I'm not gonna see you coming, number one. Two, those Sergeant Stripes mean nothing to me. You're just a regular cop in this detail. Kima's you're under Kima. So great leadership by Daniels, saying, recognizing that this guy can be useful, but at the same time keeping him humble just because in spite of the Sergeant Stripes. And as in comparisons, and this is why Daniel's character, this is why we like Daniel's character and we respect Daniel as a leader. We've been discussing pettiness throughout the course of this season by various characters. Minolti, Ross, Valchek, Frank Sabaka. Daniels easily could have been petty and said, fuck you, Carver, I don't need you, based on last season. But a great leader is not petty. They recognize that that somebody can be as of use and they get the most out of that. So what were your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Great leadership moves by Daniels. Everything you said, like he recognizes something in Carver. He knows he has to keep him close, of course. Different circumstances. He's not as close with Valchek. So he knows he has to keep him close. And then, you know, if you gotta like even within that, giving him a different opportunity, he's gonna make him earn it. Yeah, all great leadership moves. All great leadership moves by Daniels. And you're absolutely right. That's why we respect Daniels.
So we move on to your other guy, Bubbles. Bubbles and McNulty. So Bubbles goes to McNulty's, goes to the docks to meet McNulty. Or not the docks, the Marine Port, Marine unit to meet up with McNulty. To kind of meet up with Rip McNulty, give him the information about Omar. But before we even get introduced, not introduced, before even McNulty even comes out, he was on the boat. McNulty's partner recognizes that Bubbles just can't help but to be Bubbles, as he seemingly was trying to figure out whether or not he could steal a state-of-the-art gas grill that was chained to a pole. And again, Bubbles plays this crackhead to a T. That is the epitome of a crackhead move. I don't know if he was going to try to steal it, but just even thinking about it. And of course, the cop tells Bubbles, yeah, just go over there. I'll get McNulty. You go way over there. And of course, McNulty comes out. Bubbles gives him the information on Omar, in regards to the Bird case. Bubbles, Minota gives him some money, but it was not enough for Bubbles' troubles, as he tells the story of McNulty, that Omar stuck a gun in his face. He basically begs McNulty for some more money, and McNulty, of course, acquiesces and gives him some more money in exchange for the information about Omar's whereabouts.
Yeah, I mean, uh, I'll take a little bit of a different tact on this one. It shows how valuable Bubbles is to not only the show, but like the characters on the show and in terms of their investigations. Later, Bunk will say something to BD Russell about how important having people who know what's going on is. And Bubbles knows what's going on in that street. And so the great, great Jimmy McNulty couldn't find Omar to save his life. And so he needed Bubbles to do it.
Yeah, no question about it. Rawls, Freeman, and Bunk inquire about, Rawls inquiring about the case. Lets Freeman know that he's been detailed to Daniels's case. Freeman seemingly was not pleased about it. Felt like Rawls, told Rawls, did you just fuck me over? And Rawls basically in return says, if I do fuck you over, you will know it. You will know it. Won't be any doubt about it. So he's been detailed to Rawls to the new case, to the new case. That's we will later find out more information about that and how those cases are intertwined. Quick scene, but what are your thoughts on the Rawls Freeman exchange?
Yeah, Freeman, we talked a lot about like how this was just basically revenge for Rawls. So I think it says two things. I think it says how much pull a Valchek has or someone of that stature has. So that's one thing. And then I think the other thing is, Freeman, once he gets involved in the case, he's not gonna let it go. It doesn't matter how difficult it is. And that's one of the things that makes him a great character on the show, is that him and McNulty are two sides of the same coin. In terms of, that's coming up in a future episode. Just how dogged he is once he gets involved in the case. That's what makes him so valuable.
Yeah. I mean, you would think that he would want no part of this case that is basically unsolvable up until this point with the 14 murders and to rejoin his old squad in terms of major crimes. But like you said, to your point, he's a dedicated cop. He's invested in this case at this point. And of course, Rawls lets Bunk know that it's on you now, Chief. So, which I know Bunk is not thrilled about that. Elena McNulty, Nick, and Amy are meet at a house that Nick Sabaka is looking at. This, of course, was his aunt's old house back in the day. It's completely been redone. This was a pure case of gentrification, as they had redone the house and jacked the price. And he frankly can't afford it. It's out of his price range. And he tells Amy at the end of the scene, well, Amy recommends at the end of the scene about renting instead of owning. What are your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, this is a very tangible way to show why he's going to go to the lengths that he's going to go. A lot of people can understand pressures like this. And so he on his current salary, current position, it's not a salary because he gets paid by ship. He can't afford that house, but his girlfriend and daughter need a place to live. So that's significant pressure. And so what is he going to do with that pressure? That's kind of where we are at this point in the story. And we're going to see where he's going to go.
So you have Daniels, Carver, Herc, and Kima going over to the strategy for the up for the case. Herc volunteers to be on the street, of course, because mostly because these dealers are white. You have and he of course jokes to Kima and Carver about them being on the rooftops, versus him being on the street. Freeman comes in, being of course newly detailed to the case, and immediately recognizes Sabaka. So he makes that connection, and you know, and some of the old gang is off and running in terms of case. What were your thoughts on this scene?
The crew's back together, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. You have Donette, D'Angelo, and son, and his son Tyrell, in the prison, of course, discussing D'Angelo and discussing Stringer's promises and Avon's promises to D'Angelo, similar to a scene that D'Angelo and Donette had in season one, where she's speaking, he's basically tuning her out. This was similar because even though he can't physically not, you know, tune her out because he's right in front of her, he mentally is tuning her out and just playing with his son. Then he jumped into the conversation and basically tells her that, you know, they're playing you with all that family and, you know, all that family stuff and, you know, hooking us up, and completely is not buying it. Of course, we know why she's there. She's there because of Stringer, and she basically says what they're going to do for him after he gets out and what happened. Again, he's having none of it. He spent most of the conversation, not all of it, basically playing with his son. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a tough scene. Like, normally I wouldn't even watch this scene. It's tough. It's that tough for me. I don't like it. But because I was watching, because we're doing this show, I watched the entire scene. And so what I was struck with this time is because of kind of like the line we've taken on Stringer and how everything is going, is how many times she mentioned Stringer. That really stuck out to me. And D'Angelo is 100% on point. He called it 1,000%. Like you said, we know why she's there, because Stringer sent him. And like you said, you put it in my mind last week in terms of you know, that she's basically the stool pigeon for Stringer. And so he sees it coming. That's why he, in my mind's eye, again, tough. The tough scene is because of the way the actor plays it with Deanna is playing with the son. Is because he knows it's all BS. He knows it's BS. He knows everything coming out of her mouth is coming from Stringer, or at the very least, is BS. He knows it's coming from Stringer. I'm not even gonna go there. He knows it's coming from Stringer. And so It's another example. I mean, and he lays it out very well too, in terms of this is a business. Like they can say this family stuff all they want to say, but this is a business. So I really like that point. But I was really struck by how much, you know, Avon is his uncle, but the only name that was coming out of her mouth was Stringer.
Right. She's been completely manipulated by Stringer to sift information out, get information from D'Angelo, or sense where D'Angelo is at mentally. You have a fiend. We go to the pit with Poop, Bodhi, and Pudding. A fiend gets beat up for calling out the product, basically calling the product shit, which the product is.
And he never said it, actually.
And no, he didn't. Yeah, right. He didn't. He actually did not say it. He actually didn't say it. But Bodhi doesn't know that. Bodhi just sees red in terms of sees him get his ass, not see him get his ass, but sees the after, sees sees the dude after he's gotten his ass whooped by the youngins. And Bodhi basically says, you know, not knowing that the dude didn't say it, but realizing that their product is shit, and says that, you know, we gotta call string on it, and we'll see how that plays out over the course of the episode. What were your thoughts on this scene?
It's the overarching thing that we started talking about. The name who's starting to ring out is whose name?
Stringer.
Over and over again, everybody's referencing. And so Stringer's overarching plan is coming to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has all his people in place now.
Yes, and we'll get to, yeah, and we'll doubt it will further connect even more later in this episode with a particular scene with Bodhi and Stringer. You have Nick, Matt, and Ziggy. Ziggy tells Nick about Cheese and about his car being taken.
That's what I wanted to say.
Taken because of the package. Nick thinks that Ziggy messed up the package. Nick tells Ziggy he doesn't have the money because he made it because of the deposit that he made, a security deposit he made on this apartment. And at this point, you know, Ziggy is up a creek without a paddle. What were your thoughts?
I mean, like, all of these scenes are going to connect to each other. And I meant to mention this in the opening. Not only is the opening an introduction for Cheese's character, but this is also building up. This is also building up to what this season is going to ultimately be about in terms of the reach and pull of the different people that are involved. And so, A, you have at the beginning, like they're like, this is, I was hard on the wire last episode. This is them playing chess, not checkers, in terms of they're gonna peel out each individual move over the course of this episode. And so the first beginning is Ziggy gets beat up by Cheese, right? Uh-oh, he owes Cheese a bunch of money. How is he gonna get out of this? Maybe he'll go to Nick. Uh-oh, Nick doesn't have that money. How are they gonna get Ziggy out of this? So this is all building up to a realization about the strength of the counter organization.
Yes.
I'll be more clear as we go along with the scenes with Ziggy, Nick, and Cheese and his crew.
You have Valchek gets sent another picture of the surveillance van. This time he takes the fingerprints off the picture. And then you have Kima asking about the van. Of course, the van is missing. So Valchek basically says that, you know, the van has been detailed somewhere else. But of course, he doesn't tell her, you know, that the van is missing. What are your thoughts about Valchek?
The only thing that's important in this scene, I mean, the reason why this scene is there is to illustrate that Valchek cannot say what happened to the van.
Right.
Not only can he not say, he can't do anything about that specifically, which plays into why this detail is so important to him in order to get his revenge. He can't just do it himself. That's the point.
We have Stringer and Professor Lucas. Stringer has just, of course, aced his microeconomics exam, gets an A-. Then he asked the professor how to deal with an inferior product. The professor advises him.
In an aggressive market,
yes. An inferior product in an aggressive market. The professor advises him to, gives him a couple options. One, he could lower the price, but if he does lower the price, that will lead to devaluing the product that much more. Or he advises him he could possibly, I think Stringer picked up on this.
He gave him the example of WorldCom.
And then he said, change the name of the product. And Stringer, of course, takes that and runs with it.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, no, that's where he gets the idea.
This will be a setup for a scene that this will be a setup for this was a setup scene in many ways. You have Horseface, Cole, and Bunk, Russell, and Sabaka. They're back at the ports or the docks, and they give a number of the stevedores jury summons, and you know, you have Sabaka basically telling them this is nothing new to us. Our unions have been through Richard Nixon, Tricky Dick, Ronald, the Union Buster, Reagan, and you know, we've beaten them all, and we'll still be here. And he quizzes one of his guys, Johnny 50, says, "What do you do if you ask a question?" And Johnny 50 says, "Take the Fifth Commandment."
Yeah, that's definitely funny.
Oh, shit. That was hilarious. The Fifth Commandment. and then at this point, the most important thing that came out of this was the fact that Bunk, this kind of got Bunk realizing that we even got to go deeper with these guys. So that to me was the most important part that came out of this scene. Like, Bunk was like, okay, we got to, you know, go another step when coming at these guys. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the parallel is apt, right, between the dock and the streets. Like, this is the direct parallel, right? Like, there's a code of silence. You're not going to come in and just be able to just get anything out of anybody. And so, like, remember in season one, when Eileen is kind of like telling them how it is that why, like what they need to prove in order to get a wire up and running. One of the things they need to prove is that normal investigation tactics will not work. And so this is another situation where just normal investigation tactics won't work because of that cone of silence. And so Sabaka gives this impassioned speech that just kind of like illustrates that one. And then I also think if for any reason, and I don't believe they were being like, well, maybe Sabaka could be not involved in it, that speech let them know he absolutely was. He absolutely is.
Yeah,
he is involved in it. Because you can see it in Bunk's face. I mean, he's a veteran detective. He knows. He knows how people act in certain situations. And so that does that. And then I'll say one last thing, and then you can go. Also, it also shows Frank's insecurity as well, and how much against it, how desperate he is, which will lead into the final scene at the very end of this. He's putting on a nice show for everybody, but he's drowning under all of these issues. All right, I'm done.
Yep. That was the name of the episode, Undertow, unsuspected, you know, drowning, trapped in unsuspected waters, basically. So this was brilliantly played by Bunk. Because, yeah, of course they would have loved to get some information, but like you said, Bunk is a veteran. He knows they've already dealt with these guys before. So instead of just giving the summonses, which they did, he kind of turned it into a semi, you can call it an interrogation. And interrogation, if it's going to be an interrogation, that is Bunk's world. That's where Bunk and McNulty and those guys are at their best with the interrogation, because as we know, that great, great cops, interrogations are like a form of art. It's an art to it. So Bunk played it cool. He gets the reaction out of Sabaka. Sabaka completely similar to McNulty. We've seen McNulty over the course of the season just overreacts and takes it very personally, and gets, like, to your point, allows his insecurity to get the best of him. Because up until this point, Sabaka has been, for the most part, dealing with the cops, a cool customer. He's been a cool customer for the most part. But him flipping out like that and putting on that show, tipped, completely tipped, like, it's like a game of poker. Like, that that completely tipped his hand, and Bunk now Bunk is even like, okay, to your point, like, yeah, I basically I got him, but yeah, we know you're dirty. You have Eileen Nathan, of course, the assistant district attorney, Omar McNulty, they're prepping for the Byrd trial. Omar continues to lie about the murder with Byrd, and again, claims that Byrd showed him the gun. We, of course, know that's not true. Of course, Nathan has her doubts about putting Omar on the stand. McNulty actually thought he did well in his eyes. And she gives McNulty a waiver to get some to get him some decent clothes, a waiver at a men's shop to get him some clothes. Very good scene, I thought it was brilliantly played by Michael K. Williams. What he said, the line he said says, "Fish got to swim," when he was describing, you know, multiple murders with Byrd. She asked about the murder. She said there was more than one. She asked questions, well, there was more than one, and he said, "Fish got to swim." What were your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, I mean, Omar is such a valuable character, and this is showing another side of his value. It's in pretty much every other case, that person would be labeled a snitch and be talked about and da da da, everything like that. But this is an extension of season one. And because Omar I'm saying a lot of different things in my mind, but I'm like trying to be careful because we're staying in the moment. This gives another look at the side of Omar, and this will go into the tool bag of Omar's code, so to say.
Yes. You know, Kima and Carver, Kima and Carver are setting up in an abandoned row house, looking at Frog, who's, you know, the local, who's the corner boy dealing drugs, of course, that we met early on. In the opening scene with Ziggy, so they're setting up, waiting for Herc to make his move. So this scene was a setup for a future scene. You have Russell Bunk and the grand jury prosecutor at the courthouse. He comes out, says they got nothing out of the stevedores, and that's when Bunks tells Russell, we gotta, you know, go another way. Like, what do you have in terms of an informant? Do you know somebody on the docks that could give us some more information? And he tells him the police is only as good as his informants. And he tells B. Russell that, and we'll see how that plays out. What were your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, that comment is about Bubbles. It's about Bubbles. It's not specifically about Bubbles, but in the context of The Wire, it's about Bubbles. Bubbles is the best at what he does. And if you think about it over the series, I'm saying just to you, not to anybody who hasn't. If you think about it over the series, there aren't a whole ton of informants. It's Bubbles. So that's just a reiteration of how valuable Bubbles' character will be in a variety of different ways, but specifically in that format. Of course, this is a setup for also later on what B.D. Russell is going to do. But that comment's all about Bubbles in my mind.
Yes. Yeah. No. It's all. Yeah. There's without question about Bubbles. in terms of the context of the show. McNulty and Omar in the clothing store. They're in this cheesy clothing store. Of course, Omar doesn't like any of the clothes, and McNulty, he picks out a jacket, and McNulty's like, Omar's like, you know, there's no way I'm going to wear that.
That line is McNulty. I love this line. I've noticed this line every single time. I love it. McNulty goes, this is the look. He picks up the yellow, bright yellow, banana yellow suit, holds it up to Omar and goes, this is the look. And Omar goes, no, it ain't. So it's just a quick exchange by just that play. I mean, played by two fantastic actors in this series. I just love that scene. It's a great one-liner.
So you have, then McNulty says, you know, he has to go across the street to the federal building. He has his own, some other business besides that, of course, that he's dealing with in terms of the girl off the ship. And Omar says, I'll be, you know, on Howard Street. And then if I'm not there, I'm at this, then he says something about going to a club or something, basically. To see Muffy or something to that extent. So you saw that exchange between those two. Again, a setup for things to come in regards to what we're going to see, and even not in this episode, by the way, in terms of Omar, Herc, Carver, and Kima. You have Carver and Kima on the roof, or in the building, in the abandoned building. They weren't on the roof this time. Weren't on the roof at this point. They were in the building. And they're looking at Herc, of course. They're looking at Herc, communicate with Frog, you know, make his intro, you know, as far as going undercover. He has a toothpick, and, you know, Herc is loving it. He's loving being on the street and not being on top of the roof taking pictures. So you had that going on, of course, to set up for things to come. What are your thoughts on this quick scene?
Yeah, this is. I mean, I think if I had an overarching thought about like the context of this episode, it's just like the band is back together, but in a different circumstance, right? Like, and so it's showing how malleable the team is. It's not always, again, like this season is to show you the value of detective work. I mean, like in this specific circumstance, is also showing you the value of detective work and the value of this type investigative work. And it won't always look the same, even in a city like Baltimore. It won't always look the same. And honestly, it shouldn't always look the same. Otherwise, that means you're targeting the same group of people, which again, this is the message of this season. Pretty much the same crew, they're just shuffling the roles a little bit differently, and this is what an effective investigation looks like. Let me go back really quickly, because the introductory scene where Daniels is talking to everybody, you can just see the look on Przybylowski's face, like, yes, this is how it's supposed to be done.
Yeah, probably. Right?
Yeah, we're past that scene. Yeah. This is how it's supposed to be done. And so, like, this is an extension of that. It's like, you know, Daniel says to Kima, go to the da-da-da. Like, everything is moving. Like, this is the difference between humps and people who do their jobs, do come to do their jobs. Nobody's doing anything. Nobody's being a superhero or anything like that. This is just the difference doing a job. And then on top of that, it is a high-end type of investigation that requires depth and thought and subterfuge and a lot of different things. And so there'll be a line, I think, eventually coming up. It's not any type of spoiler line, so I'll just say it, where characters referencing Rawls and Landsman is just basically like quick. All they have patience for is quick. Da, da, da. So my point is investigations like this are patient and have a lot of different moving parts. And so you need to be really well coordinated. And so Prez, Daniels, given all the different things, it was like, okay.
Yeah, they're back in their rhythm. to your point, Perez was the happiest person in that room during that beginning speech for everybody back kind of together. Yeah, McNulty and the special agent in the federal building, important part of this scene is the federal building's name has been changed to Homeland Security, which is a...
It's what was going on at the time. Absolutely what was going on at the time.
Yeah. And it also plays a role, a small role in the, from the cop standpoint, in the theme of the show, as far as the direction of what the investigations and what the higher ups want to go into.
Exactly.
Dedicated.
What people care about. Oh, yeah.
What they care about.
And what they're going to, more importantly, what they're going to spend resources on.
Yeah. He asked, is you have Noti, of course, still inquiring about the girl that was, that he found off the ship in episode one of this season. Any thoughts on that?
No, we said that. We said everything that needs to be said about that.
Nick, Spiros, and Sergey, they're discussing the stevedores and again, grand jury. Spiros, of course, says there's nothing to worry about. They're going to run into a dead end. In regards to the dead girls, Sergey, of course, reaffirms that statement by Spiros. And now they move on to what's most important, of course, is Spiros, of course, asking about the chemicals. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it's all about that introduction. You're absolutely right. Kind of switching off the what's going on with the girls and moving on to kind of like the big meat of what this season is going to be about. So it's introducing that concept, which will get further explained.
Yeah, McNulty meeting with the special agent. They discuss some of the field offices that have connections or that have the deported girls that McNulty can look into. McNulty, of course, is trying to, find that if any of these girls know who the girl that he's looking for is. So we'll see how that plays out. This was, of course, a setup scene for how what's going to play out towards the latter part of this episode.
I said, is it a setup scene? No, I'm joking. Keep going.
You have Russell and Maui. Now, Maui, of course, is the dude who can't stand Ziggy. They've been going back and forth in the previous episode. But it turns out that Maui used to date BD Russell. So she's asking about the docs. He's not going to snitch. He says he's not a snitch. Before that, even he asked about the relationship and why it didn't work out. Then they get on to talking about the docs. He doesn't snitch, of course, doesn't give her any like straight up information. Cause I really don't believe that he, knows a lot. But what he does give her is a major tip about the computer system, which we'll see how that plays out. And she, of course, that gets her wheels spinning from that standpoint. What are your thoughts about this scene?
Okay, so we got to piece the scene together. Now I love this scene, but I love this scene for because it the scene doesn't go anywhere, but it's purposely doesn't go anywhere. As we'll see, that the tip doesn't. So let me break it down. Bunk tries to give BD some game. Yes. BD now tries to run with that game. That's the closest person she has to a confidential informant is somebody that she was close with on the docks, which happens to be Maui. I do not see it the exact same way. I do think Maui was telling. He was telling what he knows. He knows they know enough what's going on those docks. They don't know that they're doing stuff for the Greek, but they know who's doing dirt, where, and why. And so he is, what BD, of course, is using is his attraction to her. And so he is giving her information in hopes that that gets her on his own. That gets him on her good side, on her good side. That's what I was trying to say. And so all of that is whatever. I mean, that's fine. But the major point, and I'll connect it, when we get there, why I love this scene is because it shows what you love about The Wire. It shows how real investigations go. And real investigations hit dead ends all the time. As a matter of fact, most of an investigation is dead end. That's what you do. You investigate, and then, nope, this doesn't lead anywhere. Let's go back. Let's go to back to the drawing board. Now let's pull on another string right here. So I love, this is one of the big reasons why I enjoy The Wire so much, is because of the level of detail in its realism. They didn't play it up at all. But when we get to the actual, scene about this, I'll connect these two further.
Yes, he told her about the computers, but I don't realize he realized how big of a tip that was. I don't think he by no stretch of imagination was trying to fuck over the union or Sabacca. Let's make that clear.
I think you're viewing it from Sabacca's standpoint. Everybody doesn't see it the same way Sabacca does.
No, but I'm saying I don't think he intentionally tried to hurt.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, you think he did? Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
He's trying to get, you know, to be crass. He's trying to get him draws. So yes, yeah. He was telling her what he knew. He literally says, "Funny, you guys are running around with your heads cut off, like chickens with your heads cut off. But everything you want is right there, right there." We used to write everything down and saved in there. Just because he didn't say it specifically, like, "Beatty, you need to look at the computer to get dirt on them," doesn't mean he wasn't saying what he was trying to say. And she knew exactly what he was saying because she went and ran and told Bump.
Yeah.
But all that is for naught, and we'll get there.
So you have Ziggy and Nick. Nick tells Ziggy about the car being burnt up. He tells them, you can basically cancel your car insurance, but you do have an extra week to pay Cheese. Quick scene, but what were your thoughts?
Pressure. This is all about pressure. The pressure Nick feels and the pressure Ziggy feels, and then how they react to that pressure. I mean, economic pressure. We talked a lot last week about that, and we talked a lot throughout this show because that's a big theme. It looks different in the pit versus on the docks, but it's the same financial pressure that drives people to do certain things. So this is another step in that process.
You had the Greek and Spiros discussing the stevedores. The Greek had a great line in this at the beginning. He was like, "We need to ease their minds." He's like, "Well, ease my mind first before we even get to that." So he tells them about the Bond just tells Greek about the grand juries, because I think the Greek was kind of annoyed by that at the beginning, but Bond just says, "You know, we're good on that. That's a dead end." The Greek says, "We'll pay their lawyer fees," but he refuses to meet with Frank Sabacca. Bond has told the Greek that, you know, Sabacca wanted to meet with you. The Greek says, "No, we're not meeting. Just double his fee, and we'll pay for the lawyers." And of course, we're going to see what that leads to. And the Greek knows Sabacca. He knows what makes Sabacca tick. He knows how the money moves Sabacca. So I don't ever think that he ever even considered meeting with Sabacca. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, this is kind of like this is now putting it all together in terms of everything that we've been talking about in terms of people's financial duress. I alluded to this last week. That this is the hypocrisy of Sabacca. right? Like this is the Walter White-ness coming out of it, right? Like it ultimately becomes about the power that being able to attain large amounts of money gives you, not only the financial freedom or the ability, in Sabatka's case, to buy high-level politicians, but also the intoxicating feeling. I think that's what Breaking Bad did so well, and why people responded to it so well, and what it showed us, and now we could draw that direct line back to Sabatka now, is that earning that much money is itself intoxicating, is in itself a drug. And so while Sabatka isn't out on the streets like Ziggy trying to put a package together, what he is doing is actually levels above what Ziggy's doing, because of he's because more money, more risk, more of a high.
Well, I mean, you could have said more problems, because the more money he's getting is furthering his problems as he's getting deeper. But we'll get to that. So that actually might have fit somewhat. I know what you're trying to say. This is well played by the actor, whoever the actor is that plays the Greek. Just how subtle he is and how just economic he is in terms of what he says. Really is really no waste of motion with the Greek, or Vondas for that matter, in this scene, or even throughout the course of the series. Avon Stringer, big scene. So Stringer goes to visit Avon in prison. He discusses the inferior Atlanta product, tells Avon who has the good stuff, mentions, of course, a couple other drug kingpins, along with Prop Joe on the east side. Then Stringer asks about D'Angelo, and Stringer and Avon says the boy has to find his own way. He asks Stringer, I've been fair to him. He makes a statement, I've been fair to him. Stringer says, too fair. As much as they are in dire straits as far as their product, which they clearly are, this was about Stringer trying to get a read on Avon about D'Angelo as well, too. I think that was the main motivation for this meeting with Avon. What were your thoughts?
Could not agree more. That's absolutely what the scene is about. I mean, I think we both experienced this the same way when we originally saw it. We were originally thinking, uh-oh, for D'Angelo, which there's that. That's in there, absolutely. But we missed the underpinning of it. And as we go back and watch and discuss this, we can now see it so very clearly. I could not agree more. It is all about Avon getting Stringer getting a reading on Avon. And then, so the question that I was proposing in my mind was, who looks like the kingpin in this entire scene, right? Like, Avon always, up until this point in time, has exuded ultimate confidence, right? Like ultimate confidence. And in this scene, he looks like a beaten man. Everything like that. And so if you're Stringer and you're like, if you're Stringer, you're like, how am I playing? I'm making all these moves. Let me see if he's sensing something. And you get there, you see that, you're like, oh, blood is in the water right now.
No question.
A, it gives him confidence to make moves on D'Angelo, and it gives him the confidence to keep playing it exactly how he's playing it. And his takeover is looking very successful at this point. Could not agree more with that statement.
Yeah, Stringer was in complete control during the scene. One of the very few scenes that you'll ever see Stringer and Avon do where Stringer's in control. This might be the only scene in the whole series, to be honest with you, where you
we're gonna dive into that a lot in season three. There's a lot going on in season three, up until this point where we see
those two interact.
Yep.
Again, to your point, Avon's body language, he looks like he's down, Avon is stuck right now because he's stuck from the point of the product or lack thereof, running out of answers from that standpoint, and of course getting rebuffed continuously by D'Angelo. So he's in a bad place, and this is even despite the fact that the Tillman situation went 100% in his favor. So yeah, Stringer definitely took advantage of the situation, and we will see what this leads to, and I'll definitely have a question about this scene next episode in regards to what transpired. So yeah, this was a big scene moving forward without question. And I'll say this too before I move on to the next scene. When Stringer and Avon have talked about D'Angelo in the past, even when D'Angelo was fucking up, Avon would always retort with the family. That was not the case in this scene as well.
Well, that's why I'll piggyback off of where you're going right here. That's why that scene with D'Angelo was so big in there, because he's like, they say this family stuff, but it's business. Family's all good when business is good, but business is horrible right now. Yes. Avon has no line to any type of product, and East Side has the product and has the clientele moving over there. So business is horrible. So later for that family stuff. So D'Angelo said all facts, all truths. Business first, and business is horrible right now.
So we have Frank and Spiros. Spiros tells Frank, of course, Frank is upset that the Greek is not there. He wanted to meet the Greek. And then Spiros says, he's not here. And then basically Frank says, fuck this. And then Spiros tells Frank, we are doubling the money, which gives Frank a pause. And then he says a very important line, the epigraph, they used to make still there. No, that is basically telling Sabaka, you don't exist without us. That's what he was telling him. Because those steel ports and docks are dead and shut down. He says, if you don't have us, you're gonna end up, the union could end up like that. That's how I took that kind of subtle shot at Bond. And Bond is the guy who plays Bond is played
not so subtle.
It wasn't very clear. That was very, yes. Especially coming from him, because he doesn't say a lot. But when this was a direct shot at Sabaka, like, look, what are you gonna do without us? What really are you gonna do without us?
He pointed out their future. He played into Sabaka's fears, right? Like that's what Sabaka's been saying this entire time, right? Like, this will be the end of us, yada yada yada. That's why I'm doing all of this. And so he plays directly into that with that comment. To your point, he knows how to get Sabaka. The Greek does as well, which is why he says, let's let the money talk.
Nick and Ziggy, you have Ziggy looking up the chemicals on the computer. And you basically, again, they basically see the chemicals and see some of the prices for the chemicals. And of course, this depicts the difference between Ziggy and Nick as far as from a technological standpoint. Nick looks at a computer like, you know, like basically like, what the hell is this? And he asks questions like, you could just type stuff in, type things in, and it'll give you information. So he's clueless basically on computers versus Ziggy's, you know, expertise. And we'll see where Ziggy gets that from. Very shortly. So you had that going on in terms of that scene. But of course, the most important part of this is, of course, the what we've been discussing throughout the course of the episode. The last episode is these chemicals. Now, these chemicals keep coming up for a reason. It's not unintentional. Why? It's not by, this is by design, why these chemicals keep coming up. They're going to play a major role in moving along with the season, how the season moves. What are your thoughts on this scene?
Yeah, I mean, like, so there's two things you got to remember with so the chemicals. I mean, this is a big reveal. It's a huge reveal. And then there'll be even more explicit of it by the end of the episode. But the thing you also got to remember and connect it to is what was said. What was that? We're in episode 5, right? I don't even think it was last time. It was either 3 or 2 where he first asked about getting the chemicals. And the guy says, we need metric tons of this.
Yes.
So
double G,
you gotta put those two things together. And then you start to understand the scope of what's going on.
Yeah. Bunk and Russell, Bunk and BD Russell, they go back to the docks. Sabaka then proceeds to explain the computer system and how the cans move.
You skipped over a part.
Which part?
So they don't go to Sabaka first. And the only reason I'm talking, it's important how this goes, because that leads into like investigations doing a dead end. I'll be more explicit in when I start talking. Keep going.
Sabaka discussed the computer system and how the cans move. Bunk recognizes from the start that Sabaka's just giving them crumbs. Not even giving them anything, giving them bullshit. And that he's running, clearly running game when it comes to this computer system. Now, this computer system has been set up by Sabaka. So if you want to know where Ziggy got some, you know, that type of skill set from, look no further than Frank Sabaka. So what did you want to include?
Okay, so there's so much going on in this scene. All right, so the way that the scene opens up is Bunk and BD get out of the car, and they're met by, I don't know what the guy would be named, the foreman or their IT manager, basically. And so they're going in and they're asking him, hey, you know, like what about the security system? Now, this is important because at this point in time, they have no clue Sabaka knows. They have no clue about any of the things. None of that. So they're walking with the IT guy. They're asking him questions and everything like that. And he gets up there. He walks them up, or the IT manager, he walks them upstairs and starts to review the system. And homeboy who's there is messing up on it. And yeah, he's like, and can't figure it out. And the IT manager is like, blah, blah, blah. And then Frank comes over because he's mad at homeboy who lost the can legitimately or something like that. And the guy turns and goes, oh, you know what? Frank can probably show you better. He set up the whole system. And Bunk just kind of gets this look on and say, yeah. So it's a dead end. It was a complete, utter dead end. Because Frank set up the system. He's gang. So and then after that, then Frank Sabaka's able to give him all of the different ways in which a can could be disappeared legitimately. or I mean, a way in which the can could disappear and it not be anything, it not be anything foul, it not in no foul play in there. And so that I was waiting to get here so I could connect it back to there. This was not the, like, again, last week I hammered the wire a little bit on the overuse of plot devices. This actually was the opposite of a plot device. This was a misdirection, but a misdirection framed in the way of an actual investigation and how it goes. They thought they had something. Bunk gave her some game. She used a little bit of knowledge she had to get an inside in there, but the inside led right back to Frank. And so again, this is reiterating that going back to, remember, the wire does not, like, this is why the wire is great, is because everything means something. In all season, everything connects together. So I go back to season one when Eileen gave us the rules about how you get wires, how you get those things set up. It's because normal police investigation tactics are failing. And so they tried to get an inside man. So let's check the boxes, right? So just going up and just, you know, questioning different people that was there. Nope, they blocked that, like the code of silence. All right, so then we tried to get an informant to give us information and then go that route. We went in there, the person that we're investigating is the person who's actually doing the system. So boom, now we're blocked out that route. So the wire is, since they told us specifically last season what the rules are, now they don't have to do that anymore. Now they're just showing us. So they don't have to waste time doing that, which is why they could spend the first few episodes setting up the new cast and setting up the new dynamics, because they wouldn't have to waste time with the rules. Excellent, excellent stuff here.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on. They did not go in with the standpoint that we're going to go see Frank Sabaka. They didn't, of course, to your point, they didn't even know Sabaka had anything to do with the computer system. So yeah, that I don't want to mislead the audience from that standpoint, that they went in with the intention of talking to Frank Sabaka, because that was not their intentions at all. That's just kind of how it played out in regards to the scene. And Bunk right away knows that, you know, Frank is giving them bullshit.
Well, it's a dead end. It just is a dead end. They wouldn't even roll the trip if they knew Sabaka created the computer system. Maui didn't tell them that because Maui didn't know that. It's just a dead end. It's just flat out a dead end. It's no deeper than that. It's a dead end.
So you have Stringer and the Barksdale crew discussing.
But it's beautiful that a show, it's beautiful that a show like this takes the time to show that. That's what, it's revolutionary for its time. We got to put the show in its time and place. No shows did things like that at this point in time in television history. No. That's what we got to keep reiterating, why this show is genius, because it was doing stuff that was groundbreaking that now we're familiar with. But at that point in time, no. Stuff like this wasn't done. On regular, by no means.
Stringer meets back at the funeral home with the Barksdale crew, breaking down business and a new strategy. He's asking them various questions, explaining what he had discussed with the professor, basically. And Bodie steps up to the plate and it answers the question correctly and gives, and now he answers the question correctly about what you do with this, you with the product, if you have a weak product. Bodie advises to change up the color and create a fake competition amongst fiends within, because they control multiple towers, which was, great for Bodie. Being paying attention with Stringer. Shamrock tries to chime in and says, "I said the same thing." It was not the same thing that he said, by the way. That Shamrock and Bodie did not say the same thing. Bodie was way more clear and concise in terms of how he articulated his understanding of this. So now, to your point, you have that Bodie Stringer bond getting stronger, because Bodie was able to recognize what Stringer was talking about, And two, you've been paying attention closely to that dynamic. That gives Bodie even more trust with Bodie. Like now, okay, you're paying attention. Now I can entrust you with even more responsibility. What are your thoughts on this thing?
You're fanboying for Bodie, basically, right now. I love Bodie. You know I love Bodie. But no, you're reading too much into that dynamic right there. And I'm going to kick up for Shamrock. Shamrock was the one who suggested changing the caps first. He said it. And then Bodie added on competing in the tower. That's why Shamrock was upset. So, I mean, like, they built off the idea of each other, which is what you want, absolutely. But in a competitive space, that's not how either one of them were seeing it, because Bodie gave the nice little sly smile at the very end. But Shamrock did say the gel caps first, changing the caps.
Yeah, he did.
So I got a cake for Shamrock. I can't just give Bodie all the credit in there. But what this does show is exactly what you're saying. If we look at the evolving dynamic between Bodie and Stringer, Stringer wouldn't even recognize him in season one at all. And now Stringer's giving him an attaboy in a meeting. Bodie's not in the pit. He's at the actual meeting. So moving on up and getting some recognition. Stringer also knows, of course, now that we've kind of fully started vetting Stringer out in his plan and everything, like, he has to get his people in place, people who are loyal to him. And Bodie has been Stringer's lapdog up to this point, always wanting Stringer's approval of things. And so it's also strategic in elevating people that are specifically and only loyal to him. Bodie.
Homegirl,
what's her name? Jeanette. Like, yeah, people who are specifically loyal to him. He's starting to put those pieces into place. So not only is it psychological warfare, but not kind of like that. That was the kind of like the psychological play going up and checking on Avon, but now he's starting to move the pieces into place. The actual people in the place.
Yeah, and these are his guys now. I mean, Bodie, Shamrock. Shamrock wasn't around season one. Bodie and Shamrock specifically are his guys. These are his guys. But basically, everybody in that room is his.
Yeah. Really? But I guess by what I mean by that are only loyal to him. There is no Barksdale name. It's only Stringer.
At this point,
and so he's trying, like, just like he's trying to size Avon up, he's also sizing everybody up. Yes, you're absolutely right. Everybody there, because all the muscle's gone, all got arrested, everybody there is seeing Stringer. Stringer's trying to take it to the next level on that. And so he needs to know who's loyal to him and who isn't loyal to him.
Spiro, Nick, and Sergey discuss the chemicals. You have Nick inquiring about the chemicals, and Nick ends up figuring out what the chemicals are going to be used for in terms of processing cocaine and processing drugs. Spiro's, of course, mentions that they go from doubling the money. He asks, triples the money for the three cans. And, of course, this is a case of the money speaking for itself. And also, again, Nick figuring out what the chemicals were going to be used for, as he kept inquiring about it. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, so let me break this thing down a little bit. So the triple was for Sabaka, because Sabaka still up until that point had said no and told Nick to go tell them no. And so as Nick is talking, it's like triple. And so the triple's for Sabaka. And then Nick says to them, hey, I checked up on that thing. Now, this goes back to what you talk about, Ziggy. My man Ziggy and his computer skills, that's how they found out. Ziggy helped them look it up on the computer. I mean, got him going on the computer. And then when they were typing in, like, he literally is like, he said some type of chemical in that scene, and Ziggy goes, "How do you spell that?" And he goes, "FUC." And it's just like, it's like some complicated chemical name. And then so Ziggy helped him put those names in, and then when it spit out, it showed what these things could be processing. And he put two and two together. It's not a bomb. It's for cocaine. And so this kind of brings all of those pieces together that we've been talking about in terms of that this is a, they are involved with people who are involved in a huge, huge operation. Not just, yeah, they're involved with people who are involved in a huge operation. And so the money has the potential to be really, really flush. Not just no chill nickel and dime staying on the corner, what Ziggy was trying to do.
So you have McNulty, he inquires about the girl. He's in Jersey at this point, and he meets with some of the girls who were deported, not having been deported, but were picked up illegals, they're in jail. And he tries to see if one of the girls, if any of the girls recognize his girl. They are looking at the pictures, and one of the girls asks, "Will this get us free? Will this get us free if we do, if we are to give information or recognize her?" McNulty, of course, doesn't say anything because he can't make that, he can't follow through on that promise. And then immediately the girls say nothing, and the case, that part of the case hits a dead end. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is the opposite of what I was talking about on the other one. This is the plot device, and I can't let it go in this episode because it brings to bear everything that I was saying last episode. This is to give McNulty something to do. Just that simple. It means nothing to nothing. That's the difference. Everything that Bunk and Beatty are doing is as I said, checking off the boxes of how to get a wire, how to get everything like that's going to need for the port. This does nothing, unless somebody can tell me different. This does nothing. This is just something for.
Yeah, if you look at this episode outside of the scenes with Bubbles and Omar, McNulty didn't have these other scenes with the girls. Were not even.
No, we talked about it last week. This is a recurring theme for McNulty and the plot device that's needed for him. So isn't about McNulty. This is about the writers on this one.
So you have Freeman, Daniels, Bunk, and Russell. Meet back up at the detail. They try to convince Daniels to take the murders with the cases intertwining. Daniels wants no part of taking 14 murders, especially without a suspect, a clear suspect. So at this point, Daniels, of course, declines to take on the murders, take on the 14 dead girls. And rightfully so at this point. I mean, this case, Daniels is smart enough to know that at this point, the case is, that case is not going anywhere. And why take on, you know, why even think about taking on that at this point? At this point, they don't understand the entire scope of what is going on. And rightfully so, they just met up. They just got back together. So they don't even know how big this case is or will be at this particular time. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, you just gotta file this one. I give up too much talking about this one.
Yeah.
This just file this one away. This means something, but it won't come to specifically what it means until I think like 11 or 12, maybe 10. I think it's like 11 or 12.
Yeah, there'll be some payoff. This will be.
You just gotta file this one away. We'll come back to this.
Yes, absolutely. Sabaka and Nick. Frank and Nick discussing Nick tells, Sabaka tells Nick that all the stevedores are working today, one of the rare times that they all, that they're getting work, that everybody's getting work for a particular day. Then Nick tells Frank about the Greek's offer in terms of tripling the money. And Nick is the one that kind of wants to proceed with that. Nick was the aggressor in this particular scene. Like, you can see Nick's eyes lighten up at the thought of what could be moving forward. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it's the opposite of that. So Nick comes up and is like, hey, here's the thing. And Sabaka's totally thrown off, because you got to remember, Sabaka sent Nick to go tell the Greeks to fuck themselves, basically.
Right.
On the double offer. He was not doing a double offer. And he goes, oh, he goes triple. He said, wait, no. Frank goes, triple? He's like, yeah, they told me you were good with this. And then Frank goes, we need this, Nick. We need this.
Yeah.
Now or ever for the doctor. So Nick doesn't know anything that's going on in there. He's just giving him the paper. Remember, Nick's deal is about the chemicals.
Chemicals, yeah.
That's Nick's thing right there. Sabaka's thing is what's going on. And when Sabaka hears the triple, which then builds into Sabaka's hypocrisy, is the best word, where he's trying to be morally right because of the girls. And as soon as they triple, it's like, that's a lot of money. Guess we gotta just go ahead and keep on doing this. And he's trying to link it back with the doc, but this continues that theme of Frank's hypocrisy. And again, I always connect it with Walter White, because this is such a nice clear line of, if you've seen Breaking Bad, if you've seen that character, then you know what's at the heart of why Frank is doing what he's doing.
And that is how the episode ends with that. So yeah, a lot, just a few, like, you know, a lot of moving pieces in this episode, in regards to, again, still set up, but you see where certain things were going. We see where certain things are going to go. Chardine Award for Best Performance. I had Bondus, especially in that scene where he's with Nick, and especially with a couple scenes. Well, the one scene with Nick, and the one scene with the Greek, and then the scene with Sabaka when he says the epigraph.
I'm trying to decide. I was thinking of the person I'm going to give the MVP to for this, but I'm going to say that for the MVP. So I'm going to go with Omar for this part. Like, I loved his interactions with McNulty in the whole process. His interactions with the prosecutor. McNulty's smiling at him, and then his interaction with McNulty in the store. If I had to narrow it down, it's the one in the store that I just love. But it's real chill and real. I mean, Omar will have absolute MVP moments later on, but this is a nice chill, like just another side you get to see of Omar. So that's where I'm going.
MVP, I have V. Russell. For my MVP, she took the game that Bunk gave her, applied it, and even though it's, and got the tip from about the computers, which will play a major, major part, and have a major impact moving forward throughout the course of the rest of the season. So, I have B. Russell as the MVP of this episode.
I'm gonna go with D'Angelo. Like I said, that scene is heartbreaking to me, and it's all because of, I'll go with D'Angelo. The scene is heartbreaking. He outlines the theory of the Barksdale organization, and he foreshadows Stringer and Barksdale's relationship. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, no, I can see that. He saw Stringer coming from a mile away in regards to that conversation with Dynette. I could definitely see that. Again, we have major things to come throughout the course of the rest of the season. Big episode coming up next week. So, you know, we got this was a brisk hour and 26. I anticipate that next week will not be 26 with the number of things that you're gonna have that will be going on in the next episode, which will be a major episode to in the series. You know, and not only this season, but in the entire series of The Wire. Next week's episode is a big time shift, to say the least. Any last thoughts, Mr. Sapp?
No, be healthy, be safe.
Yeah, no question.
Be cool.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's going to be blazing.
Ridiculous. As always, thanks to Robert Sapp for joining the program. We'll see you next time.
Later.
All right. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast, The Wire Remix, episode season 2, episode 5, Undertow. Be safe out here. I will see you next time with another edition of the Real Deal Podcast. This episode will be up before midnight. Certainly before midnight. I'm out.